Women's History Month special. Silkwood. Building Bridges, your community and labor report retells the tragic and heroic story of Karen Silkwood, a union martyr. Her experience was not that unusual in the trade union movement, except that she ultimately died for her cause. We must remember her story because it is a symbol of the collective efforts and courage of the millions of trade unionists who have fought and still fight to defend the health, safety, and security of their sister and brother workers.
Young woman, Karen Silkwood left us a considerable legacy. She not only spoke out against the occupational and safety hazards of her job, but she was a fierce union loyalist. Kerr McGee was attempting to decertify her union at that time, and much of what Karen was attempting to do was in defense of her union. Her willingness to oppose the array of corporate power lined up against her was a true display of her indomitable spirit. That spirit lives on in the workers who fight countless battles against the tyranny, the indifference, the discrimination and harassment they suffer at the hands of their corporate employers.
I can't believe it's 25 years since Karen met her death on that road between Cimarron and Oklahoma City. The story that most of you are familiar with, as personified by the movie, of course, ends with her death. Karen was that type of unusual woman, a staunch trade unionist. She survived a strike, refused to scab. Scabs were run in, broke that strike. 23 to 25 people remained in the union. Out of 150 people, Oklahoma, it's a right-to-work state. The company was on the verge of breaking the union. And Karen ended up in my office along with two of her fellow committee persons. And these were the type of folks that those of us in this movement meet every day. They're never recognized, really, but they toil day in and day out for the type of jobs they're engaged in, dangerous and hardworking. And they're angry about what was happening.
was caught.
But Edgar never did call you.
I think so.
Karen! Get on out of here!
She wants me here!
The exposure that you got is under the acceptable body burden.
Then I'm gonna get cancer. I'm gonna die.
Now, Thelma, you're okay. There is no internal contamination. There's just a little external contamination, and we've taken care of the problem.
It says all that stuff about acceptable levels and all, so bullshit.
What is?
It says here, plutonium gives you cancer. It says it flat out.
Where'd you get that?
It came in all that union stuff from Washington. You got one. Everybody got one. Oh, listen to this. Genetic damage.
Meaning what?
Meaning it goes on down into your kids. It says here, gross physical and mental defects.
Karen Silkwood was a courageous woman. She died doing what she thought was right, protecting the lives of her co-workers and the public. It was her concern about the dangerous health and safety working conditions at Kerr McGee Nuclear Corporation's nuclear facility in Oklahoma that prompted her activism and willingness to challenge irresponsible corporate behavior.
Steve Woodco currently practices law in New Jersey, where he represents workers injured by exposure to toxic substances. I've been asked to retell the story of Karen Silkwood tonight, but I would like to tell you the story that's not often told of all the other events that were going on in the Kerr McGee plant during the early 1970s. I'd like you to understand that Karen Silkwood did not act alone. There was widespread support in that unit for the activities that she was engaged in. Kerr McGee was out to bust every local union that represented its workers at every work site in the United States. The group at Crescent, Oklahoma, where Karen Silkwood worked, they went out on a 9-week strike in 1972 and 1973 and went back to work with a substandard contract in which management had the upper hand on almost every issue. That set the stage for another round of collective bargaining at the end of 1974. The workers at the Kerr McGee plant in Oklahoma had been complaining for years about the conditions at the plant. Workers were sent into the plant without any kind of training. One worker lost his life when trying to reassemble a compressor and his head was blown off in an explosion. The temperatures in the plant exceeded 100 degrees Fahrenheit on a daily basis. There were ammonia fumes and nitric acid fumes in the air. Now that's the perspective within which Karen Silkwood came to the forefront in 1974. When she came to Washington, D.C. to meet with myself and Tony Mazzocchi, she was accompanied by two other co-workers. All of them said the same thing about the horrendous conditions in the plant, about people being exposed to plutonium on a daily basis. All of them said the same thing about what the company was doing on the quality control, that they were falsifying records in order to pass plutonium fuel that the government was going to insert into an experimental reactor in Hanford, Washington. And Karen was the one who said, "I will go back and I will document this for you, so that we can bring it to the forefront of the country in a story in the New York Times." Now, Karen called me up on October 7th, 1974, and she told me that in the Kerr McGee plant, we have got 18 and 19-year-old boys, and they didn't have schooling, so they don't understand what radiation is. They don't understand, Steve, they don't understand. It's important for all of you to understand that there are now hundreds and hundreds of these former 18 and 19-year-old Kerr McGee workers who are now approaching what we call the peak of their latency period. This is the time period of their greatest risk of developing cancer as a result of their exposure to plutonium at Kerr-McGee. And it would be a shame if we only remembered Karen Silkwood, and we totally forgot about the hundreds and hundreds of men and women who passed through that hellhole in Oklahoma. And now, 25 to 30 years later, they will start to develop cancer and die. Now, Kerr-McGee never advised its employees of their risk of developing cancer from plutonium. Kerr-McGee put out an employee safety manual in November 3. Here's what they said about radiation. Quote, radioactivity is nothing new. It has been present in nature since the beginning of time. Man has always been exposed to radioactivity. Exposure to too much radioactivity can be harmful. Our radiation protection program is designed to minimize your exposure to radiation to levels well below any amount considered to be harmful. That was the message that they put out in order to lull the workers to sleep over their exposures in the plant. And it was not until a meeting that the union set up on October 10, 1974, when we brought in two scientists who were anti-nuclear activists to explain to the workers the hazards of plutonium, that the workers for the first time were told that plutonium can cause cancer. You all remember the scene in the movie where Karen's house is contaminated with plutonium. There were less than 3 millionths of a gram of plutonium that caused that contamination. Yet as little as 60 billionths of a gram of plutonium has caused cancer in laboratory animals. Yet the AEC allowed workers to receive 10 times more than that over their working life. And it's been estimated that just 1/4 of the AEC limit will increase a worker's chances of developing cancer to a 50-50 proposition. Do you recall that moment in the Silkwood movie where Meryl Streep, playing Karen Silkwood, is showered down for the third time with a scrub brush, a potato brush, and what they didn't tell you in the movie is that besides the potato brush, they were applying a mixture of Clorox and Tide and Ajax to the skin in order to remove the contamination on the skin. Those kinds of incidents that was portrayed in the movie happened repeatedly at Kerr-McGee. According to the official AEC figures, 132 workers were overexposed to plutonium during the 6 years of the plant's operation. During that same time period, the AEC found 70 plutonium violations during 28 inspections of Kerr-McGee, but never during the entire history of that plant ever fined Kerr-McGee even a dime in penalty. Several hundred workers went through that plant. The turnover was extremely high, about 35% a year. Many worked for a short period of time. They got contaminated. They were scrubbed down with that potato brush and the solution of Clorox, Ajax, and Tide, and decided they had had it. They quit. While this process may have made their skin raw and removed the contamination from their skin, it did nothing to remove the particles of plutonium from their lungs. Soon, in the next couple of years, the time bombs in the lungs of Karen's co-workers will start to go off, but there is no Silkwood to speak for them. These former workers, hundreds of men and women, need to be identified and brought into a program where their health status can be monitored, and if injury develops, they can be compensated. Kerr-McGee profited at the expense of their health, and the federal government, which was charged with ensuring the workers' health and safety, let Kerr-McGee get away with it. The federal government supplied Kerr-McGee with the plutonium and bought the finished product. It is time to hold Kerr-McGee and the government accountable for the havoc that is about to be wreaked. My idea is not new. Kitty Tucker is one of the original activists who started the Supporters of Silkwood organization, which organized and funded the lawsuit that went all the way to the United States Supreme Court. Started this effort in 1977 to track these workers. Kerr-McGee immediately responded with a letter to all of its former employees and discouraged them from participating in Kitty's study. Then Kerr-McGee subpoenaed Kitty to a deposition in order to harass and intimidate her. It's time for these efforts to be updated. It's time to track down all the Kerr-McGee workers And if Karen was here, she would be seeking your support for this effort.
Silkwood had been employed as a lab technician at the nuclear facility for 2 years and was an active member of the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers International Union in Cushing, Oklahoma. In the winter of 1972, Silkwood's local had their strike broken. 2 years later, the company instigated a decertification election that would have removed the union from the workplace entirely. In August 1974, months before the decertification election was scheduled, Silkwood was elected to the union's three-person bargaining committee, becoming the first woman committee member in Kerr McGee's history. Silkwood traveled to the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Legislative Office in Washington for a meeting on September 26, 1974, with Tony Mazzocchi. Tony Mazzocchi was the union's legislative director who was active in the fight for worker health and safety. Silkwood described Kerr McGee's attempts to decertify the union and talked about the serious health and safety problems at the nuclear plant. Workers at the nuclear plant facility handled plutonium to fabricate nuclear fuel rods for an experimental liquid metal fast breeder reactor that was being constructed for the Atomic Energy Commission. One of the most toxic substances known to humankind, plutonium can cause cancer if ingested in quantities as small as 1/1,000,000th of an ounce. When I explained the connection between plutonium exposure and cancer, it took Karen by surprise, said Mazzocchi, recalling the September 1974 meeting. She was angered at how Kerr McGee was taking workers' lives into their own hands. 2 months earlier, Silkwood had been in a contaminated room without a respirator. Silkwood and the other bargaining committee members revealed the company was manufacturing some faulty fuel rods and falsifying the inspection records of these rods. If true, such activity would have vast implications for the safety of the breeder reactor. With this information, Mazzocchi and the three workers developed a plan not only to save the local union, but to secure proof that quality control data was being falsified. The local won the decertification election, but the second part of the plan ended in Silkwood's death.
Metallography, you know, and x-rays, and sometimes we, well, quite frankly, we have negatives altered. The negatives of the welds and the fuel rods, they take a weld and they cross-section it and they photograph it, and there's a defect, and they just touch it up.
Touch it up?
Uh-huh, with a pintail pen. I've seen them do it right on the negatives. They just fill in the white spots.
You're talking about x-rays of fuel rods.
Uh-huh. The fuel rods that they're sending up to that... We're sending up to that breeder reactor they're testing in Hanford.
Do you know what that means?
Well, I know they shouldn't do it.
Excuse us? An ordinary nuclear plant, you have a meltdown, poisonous gas, and deadly. That's nothing compared to what could go wrong with a breeder. You put defective fuel rods in a breeder reactor. For all we know, the whole state could be wiped out. Can you get documentation of that?
I guess so.
I mean, if you could get documentation, that'd be very important. We could set you up with a reporter from the New York Times. Get the company up against the wall on contract negotiations, but you'd have to have documentation.
Mm-hmm. I don't know about putting names in the newspaper.
Names aren't the point. The point is that if you're right, they could kill off 2 million people. There's a moral imperative involved here. Think about it. Talk to Paul. You look like a stand-up girl.
Actress Meryl Streep talks about her feelings acting the role of Silkwood in her film.
I read about Karen Silkwood in The Village Voice long time before I met her, the Karen Silkwood of our script. But throughout the whole process of researching her and in making the film, she really did remain an elusive and contradictory character. She was described almost as a different woman by the different people in her life. And so I'm sure there's a lot of it that I got wrong, but I felt that the truth of the story was so strong and so firm and so undeniable that was worth all the mistakes we may have made along the way. In the film, there's a moment when Karen travels to Washington, and the significance of what it means to be a whistleblower is just beginning to dawn on her. I think she's talking to a character based on Tony Mazzocchi, played by Joseph Sommer, and he looks at her and he says, "Are you a stand-up girl?" And I think that whoever the real Karen Silkwood was, whatever her strengths and her weaknesses as a person, she most definitely was that. She was a stand-up girl.
Kitty Tucker is the Secretary of the National Committee for Radiation Victims and the President of the Health and Energy Institute. How did you get involved with the issues relevant to Karen Silkwood?
I never actually knew Karen Silkwood. I learned about her after I read about her death in the Washington Post. And in the article I read, the article suggested that the Kerr-McGee Corporation, the group for whom Karen Silkwood worked, claimed that Karen had poisoned herself with plutonium to make the company look bad. At the time, I was interested in solar energy, and I knew that plutonium was a very dangerous radioisotope. And I said that no one would get away with such a stupid claim, that some union activist would be so foolish as to poison herself with plutonium. Then I read a couple of articles that gave more detailed reporting about what happened to Karen Silkwood and raised concerns about her death not being an accident, but actually have been that there was evidence it was caused by someone hitting her car from behind and forcing the car off the road. an accident investigator went out and found that the car tracks paralleled the road. Sleepy drivers tend to veer off the road on the right-hand side, but her car tracks paralleled the road on the left-hand side until her car hit a concrete viaduct for in a water underpass at that place in the highway. It made it seem very likely that someone tried to take the documents she was going to deliver to a New York Times reporter about health and safety violations at the plutonium plant where she worked, and that these people thought they could take the documents away from her and then she would have no story. As it turns out, because of Karen Silkwood's death, the warning that she tried to give to the world has actually been amplified as people around the country learned about the Karen Silkwood case and the mysterious circumstances under which her car went off the road just as she was about to meet with a New York Times reporter. Then I read a government account, a GAO report, which suggested that the people who had looked into what was going on at the Kerr-McGee facility all were very dependent upon seeing a breeder reactor industry rise in the United States. They suggested that millions of dollars were involved with the contract that Kerr-McGee Corporation held with the federal government, so that if what Karen had warned about were true, this could have big ramifications for the proposed breeder reactor nuclear industry. We now know from looking back over 25 years that the breeder reactor industry has failed, and the United States decided not to attempt building a breeder reactor, which is designed to be run on plutonium because of the dangers of increased nuclear proliferation for weapons.
How did you find out about Karen Silkwood?
I read about her in an article in the Washington Post, which reported her death, and the article suggested that she had been eating plutonium to make the company look bad. And it seemed to me to be a very sexist argument that some young woman would be so dumb that they would eat this very dangerous substance. And initially I said, well, no one will let them get away with that. But when I read this GAO report several months later, it seemed like the various inquiries that had initially occurred had all ended. So I started circulating a petition, and I went to a socialist feminist conference in Ohio and circulated a petition about Karen Silkwood at this conference, and everybody there signed the petition. And then I went to the National Organization for Women, and their labor task force coordinator, Sarah Nelson, looked at the documents that I had gathered together and the magazine articles that described what the media had learned about Karen's efforts to bring the nuclear dangers to the attention of the American public. And she agreed to take it up as a task of the National Organization for Women. And we began to work together and called for congressional hearings. Karen's parents came and spoke at the National Organization for Women conference that held in Philadelphia that year. And so by now it's about a year after Karen Silkwood's death. And then we were promised congressional hearings in the Senate, but eventually we got some hearings on the House side. And they raised more questions than they answered. And we learned that while the Federal Bureau of Investigation would only give a couple of inches of documents to the House investigators, that the journalist known as Jackie Cerruggi had seen a stack of documents several feet high. Eventually, we learned that there were a lot of twists and turns in the efforts to keep the American people from learning what had happened to Karen Silkwood.
What do you think it meant, if you could just project for a moment, because in some ways you become very intimate with Karen Silkwood, what do you think it meant for this young woman without any real support unit at that juncture from within the plant to strike out on such a dangerous, such a risky course to expose Kerr-McGee?
I think that, like many Americans, that she expected to be told the truth about her work conditions. And I was able to hear her voice on tape for the first time during the trial when we charged Kerr-McGee Corporation with responsibility for the plutonium contamination of her home. And we were able to hear Karen Silkwood on tape asking a couple of scientists brought in by the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers, the union that represented her plant. And they were explaining to the workers the dangers of these radioactive isotopes. Well, management didn't want the workers to know how dangerous this stuff was. Might slow down production. And in fact, they would often be cited for safety violations at the plant repeatedly because management was trying to speed production. They didn't want to fall behind. And you heard her speak on asking questions of the scientists, and she seemed shocked to learn that the substance they were handling could cause cancer, but that the so-called health and safety people hadn't warned her or the other workers about this cancer hazard. I think that she was very brave in beginning to gather up the documentation that would prove there were problems occurring at that site. And I think that she was very concerned for the people that could be injured in a major nuclear accident. And you could hear that concern in her voice as she asked some questions of these scientists who had come to provide some outside education to these workers who were handling very dangerous substances and not being properly warned.
Katie, what is the legacy of Karen Silkwood?
I believe because of the Karen Silkwood lawsuit and the fact that we won, because the jury believed the warnings of Karen Silkwood and the people who came to testify on her behalf, that the Kerr-McGee Corporation had not operated their plant safely and had allowed plutonium to escape into the surrounding community. And I think that many other people damaged by radiation were able sort of a settlement from the people who caused their radiation exposure because of the precedent set by the Silkwood lawsuit, in which a large sum, $10 million, was awarded in punitive damages for the company's misbehavior. Karen warned about problems that could happen in a breeder reactor, and we're now seeing similar problems happen in other types of nuclear facilities. The recent falsification of records that occurred at the British Nuclear Fuels Limited in Great Britain for fuel that was sent to Japan, and now more recently we've learned they've also sent faulty fuel rods to Switzerland and Germany, show that there's always the danger that people will falsify records. And when records falsification can lead to a nuclear meltdown, you just can't put up with that. So I think that the fact that this falsification happened in Great Britain came to light in more recent time period shows that people do see what Karen did as an important service, and they've done it to bring to light the more recent dangers occurring at another plant.
And what is happening at this time with the problem of radiation in the plants around the country?
For the first time, the Department of Energy's Secretary Richardson has admitted that the workers who worked in the nuclear bomb production sites were exposed to dangerous radiation and other chemicals, and he is urging that they be given federal compensation as they begin to develop diseases caused by their work exposures. In many cases, they were sworn to secrecy because they worked in nuclear bomb production facilities and to this day are not allowed to tell their doctors the substances that they were exposed to, if they even know. I think that we're going to see a gradual reduction in the number of operating nuclear power reactors in the United States because the nuclear reactor metals age more rapidly than metals that aren't exposed to radiation. And we're going to see more and more reactors having accidents that will eventually make it too expensive to refurbish these plants. And I think that they will gradually be shut down. But the people who have worked at these facilities or who have been nuclear neighbors are going to suffer some of the effects of their radiation exposures. And they didn't volunteer to take these risks when the nuclear plant moved into their neighborhood. And I think that the people surrounding these sites that become injured ought to be given some form of compensation as well.
Can we say something specific about the role that Karen Silkwood as a woman played in exposing the tragic disconcern that Kerr-McGee had for its workers?
Karen Silkwood embodied the feminist message, which was that you should assert your leadership capabilities wherever you happened to be. And so Karen had a workplace, and she asserted her common sense and her sense of justice and decided to gather information on behalf of the health and safety of her fellow workers. She set a very brave example. I don't think she realized or expected that the company would go to the lengths of injuring her, and I don't think that she anticipated that she would die from her efforts. They came from a true concern for her fellow workers, and I hope that the spirit will continue amongst the other people who work in these dangerous industries, because that's the only way we'll get the necessary protections for workers.
Kitty, thank you very much.
To our loved ones and families, we bring more than a paycheck. To our loved ones and families, more than a paycheck. To our loved ones and families, we bring more than a paycheck. To our loved ones and families. we bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and family.
I wanted more than a paycheck, but what I've got here today is more than I bargained for. When I walk through that door, I bring home asbestosis and silicosis, prolonged long black lung disease, and radiation hits the children before they've really been conceived. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones.
They call her a wench, a wretch, a red, a whistleblower. I call her a warrior. You know, sometimes I feel like a warrior just for making it through the day. Sometimes I feel like a fighter because I fight to keep the fighting away. Sometimes walking down the street is a scientific experiment, your body laid out, splayed out just for them to tamper with it. But you know, I think it's those with the scalpels who are really the rats. They want to dissect my ass because my brain won't hold still for them under that slide mark split and fill with bullshit. You know, my ass don't fit under that glass and my brain moves way too fast for that. Because if this is a movement we're making, we gotta keep moving. In this crazy maze we've been given, we gotta quit losing ourselves. We gotta use our big fat mouths to talk. We gotta use our big thick thighs to walk. We gotta follow those who chose a different way to knock. Those who banged with persistence like the Karen Silkwoods of my existence. Who chose a different way to walk, took a chance, didn't prance, tiptoe, twirl through this world. You see, I refuse to slide past, even if it means coming in last. I'm gonna stomp and rage and kick, talk hard, think thick. You know, it don't take a dick to have balls, it don't take balls to knock down the walls of this cheap joint. You know, the point's hard to find in all these worn down passions. But we got a chance if we sharpen our visions with our voices. It's a choice to make noise. It's hard to be heard. They toss you a muzzle wherever you go. But baby, it's the waves that let you know the ocean's alive. It's the roots reaching truth that let the tree survive. It's the silkwoods who in seeing keep us from being blind. Because the truth is in the roots. Because the truth is in the roots. So we gotta go deep. We gotta use our black and blues like a second skin. Let our bruises thicken, then begin again. We gotta get up when we're pushed to the ground. They ain't gonna hear us if we're screaming face down. We gotta rise to double the size of our sound. You know, wretches are better the second time around. And I can still hear her passing it down, saying, taste test the world before you swallow what they say. Chew up your own mind before you sit down to their buffet. You gotta roll up your sleeves. You gotta dig in. You gotta say amazing grace and make this thing begin.
Toilet seat, the makeup you touched, the bologna and cheese in the refrigerator, from your samples. And we're getting next to nothing on our readings of Drew and Dolly, and your car is absolutely clean. How do you explain that?
I don't know.
Think about it, Karen.
What boy?
Now, come on, Karen, concentrate.
How did the plutonium get in my house?
Did you put it there?
You know what? What, are you crazy? Think I'm... You think I contaminate myself? You think I'd do that?
I think you'd do just about anything to hurt this company.
And then I spilled it.
What?
I spilled my urine sample container. Somebody must have put plutonium in my urine sample container. And then I spilled it.
Miss Silver. We have detected americium in both lungs and both sides of your chest. Americium is produced when plutonium disintegrates. And extrapolating from your americium level, we estimate you have an internal contamination of 6 nanocuries of plutonium. Now, the maximum permissible body burden for occupational exposure is 40 nanocuries. So as you can see, you are well under that level.
As well as we can determine. These are very sophisticated instruments we use to take these measurements. But their accuracy may be off by plus or minus 300% at this level.
Plus or minus 300%?
That's correct.
Then what you're saying is that the amount of plutonium inside me could be three times less than you ever think?
Or three times greater.
But even that would be under the maximum permissible body.
On November 13th, Silkwood was to drive to a meeting with Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers International Representative Stephen Wotka, who was also Tony Masaki's health and safety assistant. Also at the meeting was to be New York Times investigative reporter David Burnham to discuss the safety conditions at the nuclear facility. In her possession, Silkwood reportedly had documents proving Kerr McGee had falsified quality control records of nuclear fuel rods. Silkwood was killed when her car left the road and crashed into a concrete culvert. Her documents were missing from the car. The International Union hired a private investigator to look into the crash when it suspected foul play. The investigator said there was evidence to suggest Silkwood's car was hit from behind by another vehicle, causing her car to leave the left side of the road and hit the culvert. 1 week before the crash, Silkwood and her apartment were contaminated with plutonium that came from Kerr McGee. She was scrubbed down with a vegetable brush and a harsh solution containing bleach. Afterward, she was sent to the Los Alamos, New Mexico Atomic Energy Facility for medical tests. The Atomic Energy Commission had to remove all her contaminated belongings from her apartment. 5 years after Silkwood's death, on May 18, 1979, a jury found Kerr McGee Corporation guilty of negligence in the plutonium contamination of Karen Silkwood. They awarded her estate $10.5 million in damages. At the time, former Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Worker President Al Grosperon expressed hope that the Silkwood verdict would herald the start of strict enforcement of safety regulations at nuclear power plants both in the U.S. and around the world to ensure the protection of working men and women. Unfortunately, nuclear workers continue to be exposed to dangerous radioactive substances. Recent revelations of nuclear workers being exposed to plutonium show that Karen Silkwood's fight for a safe workplace continues today.
Tony Masaki has served as Secretary Treasurer of the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers International Union and was cited by Ms. Magazine in 1982 as one of the 40 male heroes of the decade for his work in the effort to expose the forced sterilization of women workers at American Cyanamid. He's one of the founding members and currently interim national organizer of the Labor Party. Please welcome Tony Masaki.
There are really two parts to the Silkwood story. The story that most of you are familiar with, as personified by the movie, of course, ends with her death. The other part of the story is that would not have been a Karen Silkwood story if the work of a number of people hadn't been persistent When Silkwood was killed, I was the legislative director of my union, and Dave Burton, who was a reporter from the New York Times, the New York Times had called Dave off from reporting further on the Silkwood matter. They wanted a smoking gun immediately, and of course that wasn't about to appear immediately. The Silkwood story would have been buried, but I was fortunate enough to know Ronnie Eldridge, who was working for Ms. Magazine at the time, and I asked Ronnie, we needed a story about the Silkwood matter, and she did assign a writer, and B.J. Phillips wrote a piece in Ms., and two young women appeared in my office one day, and Kitty Tucker is one of them, and Sarah Nelson was the other. They had read the story and wanted to do something to bring the Silkwood matter to the attention of the public. It was their work in the formation of a group called Supporters of Silkwood who made this issue public. I had taken it as far as I could. Our union had taken it as far as we could. People really aren't interested in the death of a trade unionist or two, and we've had many deaths of people like Karen, but none of them ever achieved the type of notoriety. But Kitty and Sarah began the monumental task, form Supporters of Silkwood. A group of Jesuits assisted. It ended up in a trial. Jerry Spence, who you see constantly on television, was one of the lead attorneys. And it was their work that brought Silkwood to the attention of the American public, and subsequently the movie was made. And I just want to convey my appreciation for the type of work that Kitty and Sarah did and all the others who helped make this issue public. About Karen, Karen was a very unusual woman. Many people really don't know the real Silkwood. The movie did a very good job of conveying the factors surrounding her death, but Karen was that type of unusual woman. Staunch trade unionist. She survived a strike, refused to scab. Scabs were run in, broke that strike. 23 to 25 people remained in the union out of 150 people. Oklahoma is a right-to-work state. The company was on the verge of breaking the union. And Karen ended up in my office along with two of her fellow committee persons. And these were the type of folks that those of us in this movement meet every day. They're never recognized, really, but they toil day in and day out. The type of jobs they're engaged in, dangerous, hardworking, and they're angry. Karen, after we met for a couple of hours and she was describing, along with Jerry Brew and Jack Tice, the conditions in their plant, it became apparent to me after she revealed the fact that the quality control data was being falsified, and there were incredible implications to that because the rod that was being manufactured in this facility went to a prototype reactor, which was supposed to be the prototype for the FAS breeder reactor at Clinch River. Many of you probably don't remember that enormous fight about whether that reactor should have ever been built. It never was built. The FAS breeder never was built at Clinch River. But there were a hell of a lot of people who were engaged in the struggle against it. So it wasn't merely a rod that was to go to this prototype. The implications, if anything was wrong, were enormous. If those who said that if a fast breeder went awry, millions of people's lives would have been in danger. So this wasn't just an ordinary health and safety case. And during our discussion that afternoon in my office, it became apparent that Karen was the one who could do what needed to be done. I knew she would not have a job after she did what she had to do. Little did any of us know that she would never make it. It was obvious that Karen had the guts and the intelligence to carry out the task that was before her. The rest of the story is known to all of us. She died on her way to meet Steve and Dave. She's the personification of thousands of people who work at jobs and offices. And Karen would have been incredulous at the type of notoriety she's received over the years, but more so the fact that she's one of our true heroines. We have so few that are recognized. We have loads of heroes and heroines in the labor movement. Many of them lay their lives down, but it's rare that Hollywood recognizes a story of a trade unionist. You've seen a few movies, Norma Rae and a few others, but we are people who are eminently forgotten, although we make this country run. So I'm really proud of the fact that we've able to celebrate Karen's life. She died in her late 20s. In paying tribute to Karen, we're paying tribute to those thousands of people out there who work, toil, and fight for a better life. And proud of the unions that we've built that carry forward this fight. So Karen is the personification of everyone who's fought to make the workplace safe, not only for themselves, but for their communities. Because in each one of these facilities, what is dangerous to the workers is dangerous to the communities. That fence does not recognize the fact that these emissions, whether they're nuclear emissions or chemical emissions or toxic emissions, stop at the plant gate. So the Karens of this world fight to make their plants safe and by extension making communities safe. And without their unions, the community and the workplaces will be unsafe. There is no other mechanism that allows working people to protect themselves and advance their own interests. So I do salute Karen, salute her memory, and hopefully we will repeat this type of commemorative about the thousands of other people whose names we'll never know, but it's important that the story be told. I'm really thankful that I knew Karen. I'm thankful that her work is being carried on by thousands of people throughout the country, and indeed, I knew Karen would have been proud as could be of her heritage and the legend she has become. Thank you.
Building Bridges, Your Community and Labor Reports Women's History Month special, Silkwood, was produced, engineered, and mixed by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash in the studios of WBAI Pacifica in New York City. You can email us at knash@igc.org. Special thanks to Karen Silkwood's union, the Paper Allied Industrial Chemical and Energy Workers, and to the Labor Party for their efforts to keep the legacy of Karen Silkwood alive in the struggle for health and safety on the job and for health care for all. Thank you.